Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue our conversation about why no one predicted that Justice Scalia would become one of the most polarizing Supreme Court justices in U.S. history. Then, what is driving the increased violence against women in some parts of the world, and what women are doing to stop it. Last week, we began a conversation about how U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia became what many consider the most polarizing justice on the Supreme Court, possibly in U.S. history. With us now is Bruce Allen Murphy. Bruce Allen Murphy is a judicial biographer. He is a professor of law at Lafayette College, and his latest book is Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. Last week, we discussed, judging from Justice Antonin Scalia's early life, that no one could have predicted that he would become this character that he is today. Let's start with a bit of an overview of what we discovered from last week. For example, he had never been so polarizing and so brash in his early life.
No, just the opposite, Maria. It's a pleasure to be back. What we discovered in his early life was that Scalia was a highly intellectual individual, very, very talented, able to really sort out very complex intellectual arguments, and had learned through a series of bureaucratic appointments how to use those skills to marshal the evidence to reach the result that he wanted to reach in order to serve whichever boss or whichever administrative position he happened to be working in.
He gets appointed to the appellate court, and he's still being an affable guy. He's starting to carve out his judicial theory here. We're starting to see it, but he worked well with the other side.
Generally, he did. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is a real proving ground for a Supreme Court appointment. It deals with a lot of administrative law appointments and a lot of law positions. And he was on a court in which the most visible judge in the federal system, Robert Bork, had been sitting for some time. He was more senior. He had been mentioned for the Supreme Court back in 1974. He was older than Scalia, and it was widely expected that he would get the first Reagan appointment after Sandra Day O'Connor's appointment in 1981. For Scalia, this became something of a proving ground. He did get along generally with the other members of that court. He did have his moments. He used to write and argue in cases so vehemently when he really truly believed in those issues that some of his work was called the Nino Path. And he used to tell his law clerks to work very hard to get the right result because he said it isn't easy to get right. What he was able to do was work within that system and position himself well against Robert Bork. In one case, the Ullman case dealt with an academic from Maryland who had been accused in an opinion piece by a columnist of being a socialist and had sued for libel. And Scalia was arguing that the First Amendment, free press, did not cover such opinion pieces, did not protect the press. But Robert Bork argued, using a different sort of sociological theory, that in fact opinion pieces were given wider coverage. And that one case separated Scalia from Bork and made it appear to the Reagan administration later on that he was a more pure conservative. All in all, this became sort of an intellectual judicial pose down for Scalia, using the term of bodybuilding. He was able to show the administration that he was younger, that he was in better health, and that he was a little better conservative, and, they thought, more affable. He was able to get along with the other judges.
Let's go to the appointment process and the vetting process and all of the factors that kind of came together to make him the candidate that would then get onto the Supreme Court. So we have Jones Day, his law firm connections. We have the Italian-American bar who is trying to create the path for him to get onto the Supreme Court. What else do we have?
Well, we have a complicated vacancy situation. You have the departure of Warren Burger. So now they have to appoint a chief justice. Now, there are a couple of ways that the administration can go. They can take somebody from within the court. They can take William Rehnquist, for instance, or they can take Sandra Day O'Connor. But if they do that, it means they're opening up another vacancy that will have to be filled. Or they can go off the court and take one of the number of people. And there were about a half a dozen people who had been floating around whose names were well known. Frank Winter, for instance, Robert Bork, among others, including Antonin Scalia. they could be appointed directly to the chief justiceship. Fairly early on, the president decided he was going to go from inside the court, and he decided that he was going to go with William Rehnquist. So now what you're doing is you're trading a conservative for a conservative, and they're looking to fill Rehnquist's seat. And it becomes pretty quickly a contest between Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. And there are a series of people within the Justice Department who begin looking at all of the cases, that's part of the vetting process, and trying to predict what they're going to get on the court. And they predicted that they would get a fairly consistent conservative on the court in Scalia, but they also said, you're going to get somebody who will be like the William Brennan of the conservatives. He will bring the conservatives together under William Rehnquist and will help to forge a powerful voting coalition for the Reagan administration conservatives for the next generation or so of judicial cases.
Now, you contrasted him a little bit with William Rehnquist, and it seemed to me from your book that all of his drama schooling, his great talent with drama, really paid off throughout this process.
Yes, it truly did. One of the things that he was able to do just before the appointment is he had a longstanding invitation to speak before an economic conference. He knew there would be administration officials there. He could have picked almost any of his speeches to give at that point. He had been giving for about a year a very popular speech about the problems of a legislative intent. He'd been arguing and argued successfully at that point in his career that court judges should not be trying to divine what Congress meant by the words of a statute by looking at committee hearings and by looking at the debates in Congress, that was an unreliable indicator of what the legislation actually meant. But instead, Scalia presented somewhat of a new speech and argued affably, it was a lunchtime speech, that Robert Bork had been talking about this notion of original intent, that you could figure out what the Constitution or the Bill of Rights meant by what the framers, the authors of those words, intended by those words. But Scalia said, you know, I don't think that goes far enough. I'm going to propose something called original meanings. Now, this was a term that he hadn't used in his 4 years on the district court, the Court of Appeals, rather. And it was a term that he hadn't really articulated and didn't really articulate it in that speech. He'd been using a series of other techniques, among which was textualism. I will look at the dictionary definition of the law or of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And just, I think, that sort of branding of, I have a new theory, I'm different from Bork, may have helped position him just a little bit better, maybe 72 hours before the decision was made by President Reagan in the Oval Office.
It also seemed like he wasn't particularly honest in some of the questions and was able to hide this. I remember a question that you documented asked by Senator Biden, and he had essentially argued the opposite as what he said in that speech.
Well, what you have to remember about this is the nature of the politics. This is a pivotal time for the Reagan administration. Jan Crawford Greenberg has argued very persuasively in her book, Supreme Conflict, that had the Reagan administration picked Robert Bork for this first seat on the court with Rehnquist and then gone to Antonin Scalia, things would have gone better for the Rehnquist court because the Judiciary Committee and the Senate was controlled by the Republicans, and the questioner, the person leading that committee, was Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. So Scalia came into that whole process knowing, one, that the Republicans could provide cover for him, two, that the Rehnquist hearing had not gone well, and Rehnquist had a very tough time and ended up with 33 votes against him. So Scalia, I think this is what modern justices do in these confirmation hearings, found ways to finesse the issues and figure out how to get a record that would not provide objections to anybody that might cause a filibuster or some other major vote against them. The truth was, though, that the Senate by that time was exhausted and they just wanted to confirm somebody.
So from his very first case, his personality was the other one. We talked a little bit about the two different Scalias. It seems almost like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He automatically became the center of attention, monopolized the court. What happened?
Well, this is an interesting instance because political science and political scientists have gone to great lengths to write a number of really good articles and a lot of material about the judicial apprenticeship period. The theory is that when judges or appointees come to the court, they take a while to figure out what the job is. It's a very difficult job. Everybody says that it is. It's unlike anything that they've trained for. These are fantastically talented people, but they have to figure out how to work in a court of nine. They have to figure out how to work closed off from the political realm that helped them to rise to the top and get that appointment. They have to figure out how to deal with these issues that are way more complex than anything that they've seen in any previous position that they've occupied. And so usually, the theory goes, these people figure out who they should mentee to, who they should apprentice to. They figure out what position on the court, what wing on the court they should ally with, and they take a couple of years to take a breath and become a justice on the court. Scalia didn't think that was how he would do it. The fellow who arrived was not the Tony Scalia, the actor who was very affable, who the Reagan administration expected. He was the Nino Scalia, the really solid argumentation, win-it-all-cost type of person, who decided from the very first moment he was going to demonstrate that he was the equal of all the justices on the court, some of whom had been there decades longer than he had. He took over oral argument. He tried to make a point in a very minor case dealing with the inheritance of land in a Native American tribe that he had the correct theory that would solve this case. He knew the answer. And then when the case got into the conference stage and it appeared that the opinion would be written by Sandra Day O'Connor, again, there is a tradition that a maiden opinion is given to the new justice on the court. It will probably be a unanimous opinion. It's assigned by the Chief Justice. It takes a few weeks for that opinion to be assigned to the new judge, and it's usually the easy way to enter into this process. Scalia abandoned all of that and decided that he was going to take over this case. He was going to write an opinion that would try to gather up votes and steal the opinion away from Sandra Day O'Connor. And what actually happened is it took a case that probably could have been decided in a month or two, and it lasted for month after month after month. And Lewis Powell wrote on the side of one of the margins of one of the drafts of an opinion in the case, this turned out to be a very unhappy case for us. I think from that very first moment, Scalia put O'Connor on guard that he was not going to be an ally of hers, and he put Powell and some of the other senior justices on guard that he was going to be a very challenging person on the court.
If you were going to assess Scalia's impact on the court overall and on U.S. law and jurisprudence after writing this amazing tome, what would you say?
Well, I would say three things. First of all, on the question of was he able to master the politics of the court, I think the answer is no. There were instances in which he was able to get five votes and change law. He was able to help elect George Bush. He was able to help craft a Second Amendment right to bear arms. His whole approach was one of the lone wolf of the Court of One. He would rather have written for himself than try to take patience and write drafts and compromise to get other justices on board. So many of his most dazzling opinions, I think, are his dissents. And those are the ones that are going to be remembered. And they may be the ones that if there's a conservative court down the road, they may be the ones that he's remembered for. That's one. Secondly, you'd have to say that his overall legacy of originalism is a substantial one. He has changed the conversation on the court. He's changed the agenda on the court. Even the liberals have to talk about originalism. But everybody's figuring out they can do whatever they want with originalism. They can pick and choose among the historical evidence. They can pick and choose which dictionaries they're going to use. They can pick and choose what definitions they're going to use. So I'm not sure that this is a process that will change the way decisions are made, but it's a process that probably will change the way decisions are explained. Thirdly, And this is, I think, one of the things that may haunt Scalia eventually. He came onto the court in 1986, and it was an institution that had largely shied away from extrajudicial works, from speeches, from writing books, from writing articles, from giving interviews off the bench, because they were still recovering from the 1969 forced resignation of Abe Fortas and the 1970 impeachment effort against William O. Douglas. Scalia set about immediately changing that standard and began giving speeches and then began roaming even more widely in those speeches until he was criticizing his colleagues, criticizing the court, changing the interpretation of the cases that had been decided that year, saying things like, the people who do not believe in my originalism theory but are living constitutionalists are the mullahs of the West, and their views are idiotic. Now, those are two different speeches that he gave those interpretations. And what it has done is it has put a partisan target on the back of the court and polarized it. And I think it's made it acceptable for people to attack the court. And when they do that kind of thing, the public support for the court has diminished. So I think that it will be a contest down the road as to whether or not the significant jurisprudential contributions of Scalia in his dissents and his originalism theory will outweigh the kind of political, partisan, foundational damage that he's done to the court in his nearly 30 years on the institution.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudi, and we're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy about the justice many believe is the most polarizing justice in U.S. history and how nobody predicted that this is who he would become when appointed to the Supreme Court. A couple of other things I wonder. One is he does seem to have had a meaningful effect on the law, particularly in his effort to incorporate religion into government.
It's true, and it depends on what side of the issue you come down on here. One of the real challenges is, does Scalia's originalism theory lead him to the correct answer on the question of religion in government? You have a debate that begins with David Souter in the Levy-Weissman case, the school prayer for graduations in Rhode Island. And the debate is whether or not Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the First Amendment intended for accommodation between church and state, or did they intend, as Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists in 1802, for a high wall of separation between church and state that became impregnable. We have to recall that the framers are deists. They are not organized religion advocates. They believe in individual prayer. And it's pretty clear, I think, from the historical record that late in their careers, both Madison and Jefferson came to understand that there should be a separation between church and state. What Scalia has been able to do in the Establishment Clause area, he's been able to work with William Rehnquist, with other conservatives, and lower that wall and make it more acceptable for the town of Greece to say, we're going to have a prayer before our town council meeting, or for people to put a giant war memorial cross on Sunrise Rock in the Mojave National Preserve. That kind of thing has happened, I think, largely in response to Scalia and the other pro-religion conservatives arguing that there should be a lowering of the wall between church and state. He was arguing in 1990, if there is a general law of the state that covers everyone, that doesn't target religion, in that case it had to do with drugs in Oregon, then even religious groups must follow it. But, he said, there might be exceptions to that in which we will use a higher level of scrutiny and protect those religious groups. This is the case in the Hobby Lobby instance, because pretty much since that 1990 case, Congress has passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Congress has passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The Supreme Court has, in case after case after case, created new exceptions. The whole area of law has become almost like a piece of Swiss cheese, where there are more holes in which the religious groups are being protected by high level of scrutiny than there is actual cheese left of the original Scalia decision in 1990.
One area we also didn't cover is his fight with Catholicism, with one version of Catholicism, and this sect called Opus Dei. How does this all fit together?
Well, it's an interesting question. I had to look into the question of what would be the impact of the pre-Vatican II devout, conservative, traditional Catholic views of Scalia taught him by his father and by his family in the 1950s. And there is floating through the internet a series of articles and charges that perhaps Scalia is part of this very conservative group within the Catholic Church. I could find no evidence that, in fact, he was associated with that. In fact, the best source that I was able to find, John Allen, Father John Allen, said that he could find no evidence of it as well. But it raised for me a different kind of question. Scalia's gone to great lengths in a series of speeches to say it makes no difference that I'm a Catholic on the Supreme Court. I decide cases as a judge, not as a Catholic judge. There is no Catholic way to decide these cases. And he's very persuasive in making that argument from a logical standpoint. But if you look at the process that he uses of going back to original sources, of looking carefully at the meaning of the individual words, if you look at his originalism of returning to the sources, that's what Father John O'Malley uses to define what pre-Vatican II Catholicism is. They go back to a Latin-based Mass. They go back to the Tridentine Mass that goes back hundreds of years. And you have in Scalia a man who takes great pride in saying, the church, the modern-day church, opposes the death penalty. They want to sanctify life. That is what the modern popes are saying. But I go with the earlier millennia of popes, and I go with the eye for an eye approach of the earlier Catholic Church. I am in favor of the death penalty, and so I choose to ignore the modern church and go back to the earlier church. And if you look at the social values issues that he is deciding in the death penalty, in the abortion rights area, in the gay rights area, time after time after time, his views are very consistent with what you would expect from a conservative, traditional, pre-Vatican II Catholic. And his process of using originalism to get there allows him to do it and say, I'm doing it as a judge. Look at my process. It's originalism. Oh, it just always ends up where the pre-Vatican II Catholic group would say should be their position. So maybe that's just a coincidence.
The other thing that you didn't mention about his impact on the court, I think, pertains to the decorum of the court. Would you agree?
I do. This is a real issue that I struggled with. Remember, I started my career looking at Felix Frankfurter. This is the way Frankfurter treated his colleagues. He had no trouble in criticizing his colleagues, but oftentimes he did it in letters. Oftentimes he did it in private conversation. What you see in Scalia, though, is a willingness to say things that are highly critical of his colleagues, things that would eventually drive away those moderate conservatives like Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy and David Souter, and put Scalia in the position of not being able to amass a five-vote majority. He says those things in his opinions. Very early on in the Webster case, the abortion case coming out of Missouri in 1989, Scalia wrote in a footnote that Sandra Day O'Connor's opinion was totally perverse, was irrational, and not to be believed. That kind of thing is going to have an impact. And he says these things in speeches off of the bench as well, saying of Clarence Thomas, I'm a textualist, I'm an originalist, I am not a nut. Or again, I mentioned the mullahs of the West. It was pretty clear he was also talking about his colleagues on the Supreme Court who believed in the living, evolving constitutional theory. This, I think, is unprecedented. Not even Frankfurter went this far. And it has to have an impact. You don't see the other judges doing a lot of this, but from time to time you will see creeping into their opinions an occasional word, an occasional phrase that you might not have seen in another day. The other day, in the earlier era, justices would say, my learned colleague, my brethren. They were very almost regal and polite in the way they ruled in cases. This kind of change in the etiquette and decorum of the court is something that lays at the feet of Antonin Scalia. In 1992, when Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens opposed Scalia's interpretation of history in a relatively minor property case coming out of South Carolina, Scalia overnight produced over a dozen footnotes that were highly critical of his colleagues. And they understood that this was what one of the law clerks for Harry Blackmun called the evil Nino. And they knew there would be incoming fire when they had circulated that opinion.
It is fascinating. It just seems like he was hell-bent on changing U.S. law in his own image and in his own theory, despite any of the others' perspectives. And, of course, as you said in your book, and today, really alienated his colleagues.
It's a court of nine, not a court of one. You need five votes to do anything. That's what William Brennan used to say. And from all of the epigraphs that I had for this book, and I had a dozen or more, it came down to the one that I used. Well, that's my view, and it happens to be correct. I think Scalia is absolutely certain in his view. I think he is inflexible in his view. He is not someone who's going to compromise or give in. And I think he's somewhat puzzled that people just don't agree with him because he knows he has the answer. He says, it's easy. I just look at my history and I have a result and I'm handcuffed. But somehow he's always handcuffed to that ideological right-wing partisan viewpoint that has a sort of religious tinge to it and gets him where he wants to go on the Supreme Court.
And he's so cushioned by having a Congress that is, in essence, protecting him with the ideology.
These are wonderful days for him. He's somewhat cushioned now since the appointment of Samuel Alito, changing the court significantly to the right by replacing the more moderate Sandra Day O'Connor. He's cushioned by the fact that they are voting, at least in the conservative direction. But if you look at the two cases, the abortion clinic protest case and the recess appointment case, you see what appears to be a unanimous decision, and yet there is a concurring opinion written by Antonin Scalia in both cases that reads a little bit like a dissent. Well, you got it wrong. You didn't go far enough with these issues. You didn't get the right answer. You didn't use the proper test. Let me school you in that process. So even in winning, he's not entirely comfortable and happy. These are his significant successes. He has a court that's going in his direction, but he will not accept any compromise from what he wants to do, which is to change those legal standards and change those decisions in the time that he has remaining in the winter of his career.
Bruce Allen Murphy is the author of Scalia, A Court of One. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maria. It was great fun.
When we come back, why violence is on the rise against women and what women are doing about it. Stay tuned.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Violence against women is on the rise in many parts of the world and present just about everywhere, according to our next guests. And in many of these places where women have historically had no recourse or power to end the violence, they formed their own institutions and organizations, many of them transnational. With us is Amana Fontanella Khan. She writes for Slate, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Her book is called Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. Manisha Desai also joins us. She is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and sociology at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of Gender and the Politics of Possibilities, Rethinking Globalization, and she's co-editor of Women's Activism and Globalization, Linking Local Struggle and Global Politics. Jackie True also joins us. She is professor of politics and international relations at Monash University. She is the author of The Political Economy of Violence Against Women and Gender, Globalization, and Post-Socialism. Welcome to the three of you. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with this piece that you have done here, Amana, in the New York Times called India's Feudal Rapists, where you discussed how the violence against women in India is really rooted in the caste system and really that it's acceptable to violate women of what was considered the lower caste. What is it like there?
It's always, when I'm speaking about India, important to issue a caveat, which is that it's a nation of, 1 billion people, so it's impossible to make any generalizations. I spent 2 years, going sort of back and forth to Uttar Pradesh and spending time in small villages where caste really is an inescapable element of daily, society. I used to go to villages where sort of there were small little neighborhoods that were named after castes. And so you would only live in these neighborhoods if you belonged to XYZ caste. And I would meet people who were, shunned from their communities for interacting with people of a lower caste. So yes, in this particular feudal caste-ridden, areas of India, yes, there is a caste violence and rape and gender violence are inextricable. The two are linked together in a very fundamental way.
So you open this op-ed piece with a distressed father whose daughter had disappeared. He called the police, but the first thing they asked is, what caste do you belong to? Is this normal?
I think that in the sort of village where this family is based, absolutely. Caste in a village like that would dictate everything from where you live to who you marry, what you eat, with who you eat, the job that you do. I mean, it literally defines every area of your life. So, yes, it will also impact the kind of justice that you receive and the kind of attention that you receive from the police. And if you are of a lower caste to the police, then you're definitely going to experience discrimination.
So remind us of what happened. His daughter was missing. They did eventually find her. What happened to her and how did the police respond?
It was two girls, cousins, both were minors, and they had gone out to relieve themselves in the field. They are, like millions of Indians, without toilets in their homes. So they went out at night and they never returned. And a relative of the girls had spotted the two with some men from the village, and these men were up to no good. And the relative kind of confronted these individuals and had a gun pointed at him and was threatened. And obviously this relative then went back to the father and said, we've got a problem. It's important to alert the police as soon as possible. The girls had by that time still not returned. And so, as you said, when the father did go to the police, they just sort of turned him away. They actually, according to some newspaper reports, said, don't you worry, your daughter will turn up soon enough. Just look for her among the orchards. And the two girls were found hanging from a tree, in fact, just a few hours after.
Let's bring in Jackie True and Manisha Desai. Jackie True, let's start with you. Your book, The Political Economy of Violence Against Women, you said that violence against women is a major problem in all countries, affecting women really in every socioeconomic group and at every life stage. Can you put this into a context for us?
Well, that's quite a global statement, and I think that's great that you've quoted it, but I think the very next thing I say is, even though that's true, violence and the vulnerability to violence does affect particular groups of women more egregiously. And that has everything to do with the intersection of gender oppression with other forms of oppression, such as class, caste, ethnicity, sexuality, disability, and so on, so that it's not true to say that we're all affected in the same way. What I've been arguing is really complementary to a minor's argument, and that is to say that when women have lesser access to social and economic and cultural rights, they're much more likely to be in situations of vulnerability to violence. They're much more likely to be in precarious work, where they're subject to abuse and exploitation. They're much more likely to be in situations where they encounter intimate partner violence because they don't have rights to land, to property, to income, employment, all of those things that would make it easier on the one hand to escape violence, but on the other hand to have a sense of status and a greater sort of bargaining power position within a relationship or within a family household. So that in the end, why women experience violence is not just because they have a vagina, it's actually because they're relatively powerless and unequal compared to men, and men in most groups, but this also relates to the kinds of other forms of oppression that women experience as members of ethnic minorities, as members of sexual minorities, and so on and so forth.
If you were going to give us a where we see this the most, where would you say it is? Is it conflict regions? Things that occurred, for example, in the Congo were just unspeakable.
Well, I think the other point that Amana makes in her New York Times article is about the role of the media in kind of playing up and sensationalizing some instances of violence. And that causes us to kind of deflect our attention to violence over there, that's somehow not in our backyard, in our neighborhood. And I think that's quite problematic because I think most of the things that are happening in India are happening in my neighborhood, and that I actually need to have a responsibility to see the connections between the violence happening in my neighborhood and the violence happening in your neighborhood, in Manisha's neighborhood, and that there is what feminist scholars talk about, a continuum of violence that women experience often and girls experience multiple forms of violence. One form leads to another, but also in very different contexts, they can experience also similar forms of sexual and gender-based violence. But I think the point is that some women are in situations that make it much more likely they're going to encounter violence and oppression. So that the notion that if all women of all social classes, for example, experience violence doesn't mean to say that women who experience poverty are much more likely to experience violence, and that violence itself has a further impact on marginalizing those women socially, economically, culturally. So I guess that would be the global perspective, and I'm a bit troubled by the media's fascination with places like Congo and India, with in particular events in those places, because I've actually seen some egregious cases of gang rape in my own society. Police ignored, people ignored, and then once they found out, there were huge protests. I think there are, I wouldn't want to say it's all the same or it's to the same extent or degree, but I think that if we start to look at recent events in the United States, when you're Santa Barbara, I think we can see the same kind of, I think what Amana talks about in her article, that the sense of entitlement of some men to some women. And I think we are experiencing that all over the world, and we're becoming much more aware of it. And I think what we need to do is become much more aware of the connections between these forms of violence in very different societies and contexts.
Manisha Desai, would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I'm glad, Jackie, that you mentioned that. What I was chomping at the bits here to say is, you know, the ways in which one tends to, the media in particular, tend to sensationalize violence that happens out there as opposed to in here. And so I think those connections are very important to make, particularly given the amount of sexual harassment on college campuses in the U.S. that have become really very big in the last few years. So yes, I think it is important to understand the connections across these different forms of violence that women experience in all parts of the world.
In all parts of the world, but perhaps, as you said earlier, Jackie, true, not to the same degree.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's something that we should distinguish.
Well, I think we can make distinctions. You know, for example, if we just look at some of the data that we do have, for example, the World Health Organization's prevalence survey on domestic violence and sexual violence in 48 countries, we can see very high prevalence regions or areas and countries and medium to high. But they're all quite high. So it's not a question of it's a problem there and not here. It's really a question of gradation. For example, in Australia, I mean, we know that one woman every week is murdered by her partner. That's pretty shocking. We know that on average, globally, there's a 35% prevalence rate of violence against women. That means that 35% of women will experience a serious incident or pattern of violence in their lifetime. There's more than one in three. It can vary between 20% and 60% of a society. I think we still need to understand the magnitude of that violence really everywhere.
Amana Fontanelle Khan.
In the case of India, it's actually, the media has played quite an instrumental role in breaking the taboo around rape and reporting rape, and also just really putting this issue on the agenda. Gang rapes, horrific crimes against women, happened before the Delhi gang rape of 2012. But it was because of the protest movement that happened in India and the extensive media coverage that followed that, that really drew the nation's attention to the problem, and then also, sure, international attention. But, you know, I don't think that the attention was hyped in any way, at least not in the case of India. I think it was really a grassroots kind of a movement. You know, you speak to people who are working in this field of women's empowerment in India, and they're on the whole very grateful to the involvement of the press.
If I may just add that, in fact, you know, the contemporary women's movement in India started with a rape of an Adivasi, which is an indigenous girl, you know, back in 1980. And in some ways, at the time, a lot of women's activists and feminists who were part of the media that made it possible for the media to focus on that. And I think the current focus on media is actually quite different, even in India. And while there is a very strong feminist movement, a lot of the feminists themselves are kind of concerned with the kind of coverage that happens. So there's also responses within India after the rape of Nirbhaya, which was name given to the woman who died after the 2012 rape, was a kind of very extremely violent responses to that. So in some ways kind of undermine the feminist and the women's movement articulation of rape and violence to sort of then the response being, okay, let's pass a rape law that's very restrictive or a rape law, you know, and sort of bringing out a lot of nationalist and chauvinistic kind of responses. So the current media focus on rape in India is sort of more complicated and I think troubling to a lot of feminists and women's groups in India itself.
Let's talk about the movement just a little bit, because this is part of what your book was about, Amana, was about this one particular pink gang that developed in India.
My book is about a women's group called the Gulabi Gang, which is a pink gang in English. They're a group of around 20,000 women that are based in the state of Uttar Pradesh, where these recent rapes happened. The gang was founded by a woman called Sampat Pal, who was married off at the age of 12, had the first of her five children at 15. She comes from a relatively lower caste, and she experienced many of the kind of feudal kind of discrimination that one does living in a small village in Uttar Pradesh. And she and the women in her gang have, you know, decided to fight back. They've all donned these pink sari uniforms. They carry pink sticks and they fight against men who abuse their wives and they take on corrupt politicians and crooked police. I think that their story is very important because one thing that I have felt was problematic about the coverage is that very often, you know, women are portrayed as merely victims, women who are just raped and violated but who are just passively receiving this violence instead of actually, you know, being actors and exercising some kind of agency in a response to the violence. And these, the women that I wrote about, do precisely that. Many of them have experienced marital rape and gang rape even, but they're fighting back. And I think this is very important, you know, to recognize that there are women across India who are really taking a stand and doing something to change the situation.
Are they in this particular pink gang across caste as well, or are they primarily of one or two castes?
They're predominantly lower caste. They're not all Dalits, so they're not all from the very, very lowest caste, but on the whole, these women are poor, they're illiterate, they are landless agricultural workers. They're sort of the dispossessed. And the reason that they are essentially joining this, you know, sort of vigilante organization is because they just do not think that the justice system responds to their needs.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about violence against women and what women are doing about it. Manisha Desai, you've been looking transnationally how women are organizing across the globe.
And I think just like the Gulabi Gang, I think what's important to realize, particularly for a lot of, the Global South, is that the kind of organizing that happens in the West doesn't necessarily reach, whether it's through the legal aid or, you know, shelters or various other kinds of services that we are more used to in the Global North. And so, for example, in India and elsewhere, there also actually started in Morocco, women's courts, and these are women from poor communities, primarily in urban areas, you know, within slums, who've organized to essentially form their own kind of court to monitor violence and to bring to justice men who, you know, perpetrate violence against women. So they essentially train women from the communities, and there's this, you know, a hearing. They bring together the person and the families, because very often women don't have the option to leave in a situations of abuse. And so the focus has been to involve the men and families who engage in such violence to essentially, you know, write a contract, and then the paralegals who are trained to essentially monitor what happens in this family. You know, that's one example of the ways in which poor women, particularly in urban areas, who don't have access to law and to other services, are kind of organizing themselves to, you know, address issues of violence that happens within their homes and, you know, within their communities.
Manisha Desai, in one of your edited volumes, there were some Latin American examples as mm-hmm. well. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, these were groups that had actually been using radio, community radio, as well as actually computer centers, you know, community computer centers to bring together. Because what they found was that these computer centers within telecenters in their communities were essentially being used by young men to really look at pornography rather than what they were meant to be used for, was for literacy in other areas. And so once women began to see that, they organized and actually brought those young men to really task for the kind of work they were doing. So there's been a lot of organizing, and this is happening particularly in Peru and then in Ecuador as well. There were women who had organized locally through various kinds of women's movements to deal with issues of violence against women. And of course, currently both in Peru and other places, through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, particularly in Peru around the Sandino Luminoso, the guerrilla warfare and the violence and rape that was committed through that, there's, you know, a lot of work being done there too. So I think in a lot of different communities around, you know, the world, women have been organizing locally, you know, using other NGOs and women's movements to address these kind of issues.
Jackie Tru, you've also been tracking some of these transnational networks.
I think these local movements that Manisha is speaking about have been empowered by a broader global movement to recognize violence against women as violence. And, you know, that begins, I guess, with the United Nations Declaration in 1993, coming off the Conference on Human Rights, where women's human rights were recognized. And I think now we've sort of got awareness that there are all these forms of violence that have gone under the radar, that have been quite silent and have been committed very often in the private sphere. But I think now what we need to do is really to understand the root causes of the violence globally, and to be able to also have a framework that kind of helps us to understand the connections between, you know, forms of violence happening in different regions and different localities. One of the things I think we might do there is to look at the impact of transformations in the global economy, with respect to the increasing competition for cheap labor and for, you know, states to attract investment, and increasingly also through promoting women's participation in the labor market. And I think that there is a connection between what you might say is the feminization of the labor market and the increasing exploitation of women, and also the empowerment of women by changing economic processes, and also the violence they're encountering as well. And I think there's some very interesting research which shows that whilst I think that when women have a good economic and social status, they're much less likely to be vulnerable to violence, men's violence, that it is true that we see new forms of violence occurring, especially in middle-income countries where women's status is rising, partly due to changing social and economic conditions. When women take up employment, for example, made possible by the opening of global markets, and that this newfound status actually leads to a backlash from men in their families, in their communities, who feel they have lost their entitlement to power, to jobs. I think this is an area that we need much more research on. We need to understand, you know, I mean, I think those who've worked, for example, on microfinance and how women have benefited through kind of collective loans, and how that actually may also lead to a backlash in family where men also seek to control those new funds and that new wealth. I think that research shows that it's a kind of a complex gendered dynamic. And I think that we also need to understand the relationship between changing, you know, global economic and social relations and changing gender relations and violence, because they don't, you know, it's not as if we empower all women politically and economically, not that that's an easy task, that somehow violence will go away, because it is about the contestation over power.
Amana Fontanella Khan, you wrote about moral blind spots that are there partly because people have been embedded in this structure for so long that it's sort of the way it is.
As we've discussed, violence against women emerges out of structural inequality, the weakness of women vis-a-vis men. And so in a system like the caste system, which is so clearly hierarchical, and where inequality is within the DNA of the caste system, it's very clear that this will create a situation where violence against women becomes permissible, and where once you have a system where you're not seeing your fellow man or fellow woman as an equal, then their pain, their violence that is committed against them, just simply does not resonate in the same way that violence against someone of your own position would. And I think in the time that I spent out in India, and in particularly in the small villages in Uttar Pradesh, it was just very evident that the lower castes were exposed to violence at a much larger degree because they were just simply not seen, as being worth as much as someone of the upper caste.
Jackie True, these blind spots, yeah. I want to get into how we transcend them. Moral blind spots that people don't even consider that they're doing something that is violent, perhaps. At the same time, we're seeing some advancement of women into political power positions. Does that make a difference?
I think it's a very good point that how we understand and what we see as violence and how we understand it is really different across societies. But I think increasingly with these global frameworks and definitions, I think that's really helpful to activists in kind of really using a kind of a benchmark to, or a light to shine upon these practices and to show that they are, if not illegal, then abhorrent to most of the people in the world. In terms of, women's participation in politics and their representation in parliaments and legislatures and leadership, I think it can make a huge difference. But of course, I think one of the trends we're seeing is because when women take up those positions, they are also, gaining access to power. And I think some of the new forms of violence we're seeing is where violence is really explicitly targeted at political women, at women seeking political positions, and women who are human rights defenders of women and men's human rights. And I think this is quite a deliberate and conscious attempt in many instances, and often in relation to the group that women represent, which is not just women, but you know, it could be also their ethnic or class group. But it is an attempt to diminish that power and to resist the transformation of power in a more gender equal way. So again, I mean, I don't see that there's this kind of a gradual advance where women will become equal with men. It's a struggle, and it's a struggle in every place. And I think we can start to see, especially in the Asia Pacific, where we have, though it's the largest global region, we have actually the lowest, perhaps if we also encompass the Middle East, some of the lowest rates of participation and representation of women in the world. And that where women have kind of achieved leadership roles, it's typically through their connections with male relatives. But I think there is a connection there, because I think the more that we push to have women's voices heard in the public space, the more they are able to kind of raise these issues, you know, and kind of name violence and gendered violence as a problem.
Well, I think it's important that which women are we talking about, which women come to power, because I think women are not a homogeneous group, and depending on their, you know, class and caste and race affiliations, the kind of issues they're going to bring into conversation will also be different. And in fact, there was just a study done, for example, India has 33% of women's participation in local election councils. And a lot of them, so, you know, you have now over 2 million women in various local villages in power through various villages in India, and yet most of their power is wielded by the men in the families or men in the communities. So, again, just having women in political power, you know, it's one step, but how women are brought into power and who the women are also makes a big difference to the kind of issues that they're going to raise.
I think I would say just one thing. If we were just to kind of look at the I completely agree with Manisha's point, but if we were to just look at the big picture, we would see that, of course, there is a relationship between women's increasing political voice, whether that's through formal representation or through the presence of transnational feminist movements, and the attention to violence against women, the laws passed aiming to protect and prevent that violence, and also the global media attention to the problem of violence against women.
I think that has more to do with the women's movements all around the world rather than just women in power.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we need to see, when I talk about women's political voice, I mean, part of that is, of course, women's movement, political voice.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Amana Fontanella Khan, Manisha Desai, and Jackie True. It's a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amana Fontanella Khan writes for Slate, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Her book is called Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women in Power in India. Manisha Desai is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and sociology at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of Gender and the Politics of Possibilities, Rethinking Globalization, and she's co-editor of Women's Activism and Globalization, Linking Local Struggle and Global Politics. Jackie True is professor of politics and international relations at Monash University. She is the author of The Political Economy of Violence Against Women and Gender, Globalization, and Post-Socialism. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows that's how it goes.